And welcome to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak in for Marty Musk-Cohen. Do you have any idea how much your boss makes? How about your coworkers? Salary can be a sensitive subject, and knowing what others make can boost or bust morale. This hour, we're talking paychecks, who makes what, why disparities still exist, and even how to negotiate for more. But we begin with the movement towards salary transparency. Is it a way to combat pay inequality, or is it information best kept confidential? We invite you to add your voice to the conversation. Of course, you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times or email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. And of course, you can always call us at 888-477-9499. That said, our first guest is Zoe Cullen, Assistant Professor of Business Administration at the Harvard Business School. She studies and writes at length about this issue of salary disclosure, and she joins us now to help us understand what happens when salaries are no longer secret in the workplace. Zoe, welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
So, why are companies moving towards salary transparency these days?
I think there are a couple reasons. In addition to the more vocal social movement, there's increasing research out there showing that salary transparency can, in many ways, improve the efficiency of a business.
How so?
Among them, I think one of the most compelling reasons is that currently employees seem to have underestimated what their boss or their boss's bosses are earning in many of these workplaces. And as a consequence, the financial incentives that an employer may have set up in order to motivate employees is failing due to the lack of transparency.
Hmm.
And so revealing to employees just how much more they might earn if they were to be promoted is one reason why salary transparency has proven to be a motivating force for employees at some firms.
So it sounds like you're saying that's an incentive that, hey, if I just do the following things, I can get promoted and I'll be at that level myself at some point.
That's right. And it's important that this is paired with information we now have that there's not, in addition, a social aversion to learning about higher inequality within your own organization.
Hmm.
So you can imagine a countervailing force where you learn that your boss is making twice as much as you earned, or thought they earned. And instead of being motivated, you're actually demotivated by this news. But we've seen now increasing evidence that that's not the case, or at least the incentive effect is dominating.
Hmm. Well, I want to talk about that because you have done a lot of work around what happens when people do begin to find out what their coworkers and their supervisors make. I know you did an experiment with a bank in Asia that was really telling. Tell us about the experiment and some of the things that you learned from that.
Sure. Thanks for asking about this. So the way we paired up with this with a bank that sort of spans many different regions in Southeast Asia, and they would be familiar to many Americans in that they had a policy that explicitly prohibited employees from discussing their salaries at the time that we entered. And then they gave us permission to sort of slowly introduce information about what peers are earning and what bosses and bosses' bosses are earning to individuals. And we did this slowly, so batch by batch. And importantly, we also took the time to ask before giving any information out what employees believed that others were earning. Because up until now, we'd had very little information about what people's perceptions were, given these veil of secrecy. So the first finding was just how pervasive misperceptions were. So most people underestimate what their boss is earning. The average would be around 25%, but there's also a tail of people who are underestimating what their bosses earn by over 50%. When it came to knowing what peers were earning, just as many people seem to underestimate what their peers were earning as overestimate. So you can imagine the implications for salary transparency policies are very different as a consequence. You're going to shift just as many people's beliefs in one direction as in the other when it comes to information about what their direct peers are earning.
And it was interesting to me, Zoe, that part of your experiment was finding out how much it was worth to people to know what their coworkers were making.
That's right. In addition to this, we also created a market for the salary information. So we would ask people what they would be willing to pay to have the information. And this was done in a way that we encouraged truthful reporting because we were actually willing to give either some salary information to people or we were going to give cash rewards. And we saw that even when the cash rewards were quite high, people were still willing to choose salary and or salary information. So on average, people were willing to pay about 2 weeks' worth of their salary to have a signal about what the average of their peers were earning and the average of their managers.
That's a lot of money. So that speaks to people placing a high value on having that information.
Exactly. So this combination of having a high value for the information and yet at the same time knowing very little was evidence to us that there are these information frictions in the workplace, something preventing people from talking. Of course, there's the explicit policy, but as we all know, there's still conversations that happen at the water cooler. So we went in and we were both very curious how information would spread in addition to what the impact of this information would be.
So bottom line, what kinds of reactions did you see? If people found out that their coworker was making more than they thought they were making for perhaps equal work, did you see a sense of resentment building? What kinds of reactions did you observe?
When it came to learning about the managers, we saw almost uniformly an increase in effort. So people would stay longer hours, send more emails, sell more credit cards in response to finding out that their boss and their boss's boss in positions that they could be promoted to were earning more than they thought. Hmm. Now, it was a different story entirely when we introduced information about peers. When we were introducing information about peers, people reacted in the direction of the information. So if they were learning that they were above average and more than what they expected others to earn, then we saw their effort increase as well. If they found out that they were earning less than where they thought they were in the ranking, the reaction was the opposite. So people would be discouraged, working less. And in fact, they even reported wanting to see less inequality overall in the bank when they found out negative information about their own standing among peers.
And did you see people deciding maybe to start looking for other jobs, people deciding that they're going to put in less effort because they feel that they're not being compensated to the degree that perhaps the coworker in the next cubicle is?
Yes, so yes, we saw evidence of that. And in fact, now we're about a year and a half out, we'll be able to see whether they, in fact, left the bank and took other jobs, higher paying or lower paying jobs. But at this point, all we know is that the number of hours that they worked was significantly less. And so the trend towards leaving seemed to be apparent.
Yeah. I want to read a couple of comments from our listeners coming from Facebook. Ben says, as a state government employee, my salary is available to anyone online. So we certainly see that. A comment from Nancy, who says, this was probably a taboo topic in the past, so employers could pay people unfairly. Zoe, that brings up an interesting point, because it really has been a taboo. At least here in the United States, there has been a great reluctance, I think, for people to discuss their salaries. It just wasn't done. Why are we so reluctant to talk about these issues?
Well, so what we found was even if we were after we gave information to a particular individual in the bank and we the next day or the next week asked their very closest friend at that bank, the person that they had lunch with, the person that they emailed the most frequently, to see if they had also learned the same information we had given about salaries, we were shocked to find that that information did not travel. So there was very little, there was a high reluctance to share the information, even when we were coming in and directly giving it away. Now, I think that this result has to be paired with another finding. So when two people gossip, there's inherently an identity associated with the salary information. And when we asked at the very end to the employees we were working with, would you be in favor of a website where everybody's salary was posted next to their name, we found overwhelming resentment for this policy idea. And in fact, we asked the question very similarly: would you want a website where just the averages of the employees were posted? And saw that in that case, we got the majority of people in favor. So essentially, like moving away from a method of high transparency about which individuals are making what, toward an anonymous way of revealing salary information, really shifted how many people were in favor of such a policy.
So then at least people can have a ballpark idea without naming names and get a sense of whether they're in the right range or feel that they're in the right range for the work that they're doing, is what that sounds like.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
Yeah. And since you conducted this study in Asia, I'm wondering, do you think that the results might have been any different in the U.S., in Europe, in another continent, or do you think that this would probably be consistent across the board?
Well, I would absolutely love to see work like this replicated in other settings. One advantage we had with this setting was that in the countries that the bank was operating, there were parts that had been colonized by the French, there were parts that had been colonized by, had been run by the Chinese for a millennium, and other parts that were, there was a Khmer region. So we did get to split the data to see if having different cultural backgrounds made any difference for the reaction people had towards salary transparency. And we didn't find any support for differences across those regions. Hmm. Now, this is not to say it shouldn't be replicated in other contexts, but for us, this was suggestive evidence that the salary taboo is fairly pervasive.
Yeah, it certainly sounds like it is, that it's not just a United States thing, although I think we seem to have been particularly reluctant to discuss those issues. In our final minute or so here, Zoe, I do want to ask you about something that struck me as interesting that I read this morning that said that, you know, in some cases, if everybody knows what everybody is making, then employees can attempt to negotiate for, you know, the highest paid position. In other words, to bring themselves up to the highest paid employee, if we all know what everybody makes. But that in turn can cause employers to negotiate more fiercely, that is, to negotiate in a way to try to keep salaries down, since everybody knows and everybody is aiming for the top number. What do you make of that? Is that a legitimate concern?
Yes, I think it's capturing sort of the short-run effect and the long-run effect, which can be quite different. So I think this first part that, you know, essentially if we were to introduce transparency, people who found out that they were being paid less than others doing similar work might be able to have a strong bargaining position and ask for equal pay. And that would be a kind of the expected short-run effect on wages. In the longer run, employers will now face a different negotiation environment where if they raise the wage of the highest earner and they expect everyone to be able to see that, then that means raising the $1 for one worker means raising another dollar for many workers.
Yeah. Well, Zoe, I've got to stop right there because we're about to take a break. But thank you so much for being with us on Radio Times and sharing the results of your study with us. Really fascinating information.
Thank you very much for having me.
And we'll be right back. And welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowain. Do you have any idea how much your boss makes or how much your coworkers make? We've been talking about salaries this hour and salary transparency. I want to spend a little bit of time shifting gears just a bit to talk about CEO salaries and a couple of other issues related to that. The Associated Press has released its annual CEO pay study. And for example, Tesla's Elon Musk is the runaway winner with an annual compensation package worth, are you ready, $3.2 billion. The next highest, that is billion with a B, the next highest paid CEO came in at a measly $129 million. But at most workplaces, employees are blissfully unaware of how much bacon their bosses and coworkers are bringing home. But that is starting to change as companies are moving toward greater transparency in everything, including take-home pay. And that's what we've been talking about. Who makes what and whether that information ought to be disclosed around the office or even to the public. We'll also talk about those CEO salaries and the wage gap and offer some practical tips on how to increase your own paycheck if you think a raise is due. Of course, we would love for you to join in the conversation. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can call us 888-477-9499. Meantime, joining us in the studio are Nancy Rothbard, Professor of Management and Chair of the Management Department at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School, and Peter Capelli, Professor of Management at the Wharton School and Director of Wharton's Center for Human Resources. He is also the author of Will College Pay Off? A Guide to the Most Important Financial Decision You Will Ever Make, which is a topic for a whole other show. Welcome to both of you to Radio Times.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tracy.
Well, so you've been listening in to the first part of the show where we were talking about salary transparency with Zoe Cullen, who does a lot of research on this topic and how companies are moving toward greater transparency, either in a specific way or in a more general salary range kind of way. Love to hear your thoughts about that whole idea of salary transparency and where we're going with that. Nancy?
Well, I think it was a really interesting conversation. And one of the things that Zoe raised is this distinction between the boss and the coworker and how people react to that. And I think that that's a very interesting distinction. The other thing that she raised, which I think bears more discussion, is the distinction between feeling comfortable with transparency on average, you know, knowing kind of what the ranges are, versus having your name associated with your salary right out there in boldface, and people's comfort with that. And I think those two things are fascinating. There's been actually a lot of research over, you know, the last couple of decades on issues around pay, equity, how people feel when they find out that they're paid more or less than their coworker or their peer. There's actually a theory called equity theory, which talks about how when people feel that they are, you know, doing a lot and then they're not rewarded appropriately, or that they're doing more than somebody else, they feel a sense of inequity, and then they start being demotivated. And so, you know, I think a lot of what Zoe was talking about with the peers really falls beautifully into that kind of set of research. The piece about the boss was really interesting from the perspective of, you know, aspiration, right? People wanting to have some aspirational goal to achieve, and that might be motivating. Although I think one of the challenges there, and I'll leave this to Peter to talk more about, is this issue around, can we all get there, right? What's the opportunity set in terms of how many boss positions are available? And so maybe we believe that we can get there, even if there's only one position to move into, and there's a lot of us in that, you know, coworker pool.
And I was struck by that because I thought some people can be a couple of steps away from that promotion. But if you know that you're never going to attain that level, or that you'd certainly have to go to school perhaps and gain some more skills and knowledge and all of that, and maybe that's just out of reach, I wondered if that could have the opposite effect, where there's a sort of hopelessness that sets in.
Yeah, that's absolutely, you know, in line with what a lot of the motivation research talks about, which is goal setting theory. So there's a goal that there's goals that you have, and they have to be difficult but achievable. And when they're not seen as achievable, that it doesn't work in the same way. Yeah. And so those, there's a lot of nuance around it, I think.
Yeah. Peter Capelli, what do you say? You've been listening into the conversation. What are your observations?
I think what Zoe was talking about and finding, and maybe particularly the case in this bank, is that if you think you're going to get promoted to your boss's job, so if, for example, you are a lawyer, an associate lawyer, you might really be motivated by knowing what partners get paid because you think that's what I could go for. You know, in the U.S., though, we don't have that much internal mobility anymore in the usual way, and particularly these things we used to call job ladders, where it was very clear what was going to happen to you if you did a good job and stayed around. So, you know, in the U.S., we fill only about a third of vacancies in companies from within anymore, so it's mainly hiring from the outside. So in that context, it's not clear to me that this would motivate anybody. I think the research that Nancy points out, which has been around for a long time, you know, suggests that if I feel I'm underpaid relative to other people, particularly for doing kind of similar work with peers, it really irritates me. increases turnover, absenteeism, all kinds of bad outcomes. I think, you know, this the boss level thing, this resulted from a change in the tax code introduced by Senator Menendez a couple years ago to report the ratio of CEO pay to the average worker pay. And at the time, people kind of wondered, what was the point of that? Who cares about it? It was, frankly, pushed by the labor movement. And the reason was they thought it would embarrass companies. And it probably has, exactly for the reason that you're describing with the Elon Musk story. You know, how can you possibly justify that much pay? And as a way to kind of try to justify changes in the attitudes of people on that. So maybe we could say just a little bit about CEO pay and why it jumped up so much. There was a change in the tax code in 1994, which prohibited companies from deducting salaries for top executives of more than $1 million. So what the companies did in response is that they jumped the contingent pay, that is performance-related pay, and they gave people stock options and all kinds of other things, which were exempt from that tax
code. It was a way of working around that.
It was a way to work around it, right. Yeah. And then they caught the extraordinary explosion of the stock market in the 1990s, and suddenly these executives who were paid $1 million and maybe a little more were now paid $10 million because they caught the increase in share prices. And from that point on, CEO pay then was at a higher level. And it's hard to crawl back from that, right? And so, you know, Elon Musk's salary is not $1 billion, right? It's just that he happens to own a big chunk of Tesla. And as it increased and as he had stock options leveraging that, his compensation goes up enormously, right? So that's why the CEO pay began to get so incredibly out of whack in the U.S.
So you just mentioned that once you get to those levels, it's hard to go back. But I wonder, when we start seeing numbers like even $129 million, which was the runner-up to Elon Musk, are those numbers sustainable?
Well, they're sustainable in the sense that if you control your compensation system, you can sustain them forever, right? If you're the chair of the board and you appoint the board members who set your pay, and, you know, can you come up with reasons why you should be paid that much? For sure. I think one of the things that doesn't seem so obvious, but you could start to see how it would help you enormously, is if you can shift the criteria over time as to how my pay is set. You know, and one of the criteria might be I should be paid at least as well as other executives, right? That bumps you up. And then I should be paid at least based on the performance of the company this year. And if you can start layering on all those different ways to pay me, you can be pretty sure that your pay is going to be, you know, up at the very top. I think you do raise a really interesting question, though, in that we think about compensating top executives really differently than we think about paying everybody else. So, for example, you'll hear all the time executives telling you that we have to pay this much or we will lose these people, which is not a conversation you typically hear at the very lowest level. You can also hear them say, if we don't pay them above average, we're going to have a below-average company. But you don't hear that conversation for folks at the lower levels. And you also hear them say, we have to give them a big piece of the action, right, as an incentive. And you don't hear that conversation for people below. So we got kind of this two-tier kind of approach inside our workplace. We're treating the top folks really differently, even as how we think about pay, than everybody else.
Is there also, Peter, a lack or a shortage of top talent that places a premium on those people who are positioned to lead these kinds of companies? Is that part of the argument, or is that not really?
Well, I guess that's going to depend on how you define talent. So if you define it as we only want somebody who has already run one of these companies before, then for sure that's going to happen. But if we say, look, we're going to look inside our company to say who would be willing or capable of leading the company, if we look at it that way, that pool's pretty big. What we don't say, though, for those folks is how little can we pay them to get them to take this CEO job. And in the rest of the workforce, we say that all the time.
Yeah. So right? It's a completely different
approach to paying people.
Yeah. But I think that there's another piece that, Peter, you mentioned that's really important, which is that we think about this not just in terms of salary, but in terms of contingent pay, right? And in terms of market-based outcomes, which can really balloon and get very – that's why the compensation gets so out of whack in terms of the ratio. it's not, as Peter said, the salary that is so enormously different. I mean, it is different, but it's these stock options and then the market-based valuation of those stock options. And then what happens a lot of times is that people think that, okay, the CEO controls a lot of decisions around strategic decisions around the company. And so they are going to we want to align their incentives with the company's market value being high.
Yeah.
And so that's why a lot of that conversation shifts.
Yeah. And then if you'll allow me to determine what constitutes doing well, I can be pretty sure I'm going to make out compensation-wise pretty well. But, you know, thinking about the other point Nancy made, if you think about even on salaries, if we're going to pay all our executives above average, right, and the pool of people we're drawing from for comparisons is the same, that pay is going to go up forever, right? Because every time a pay gets set for one of them and it's got to be the board wants it to set above everybody else's. And then the next CEO's board says the same question. And then, you know, pretty soon they go up and up forever.
Yeah.
Right?
To what degree is executive compensation tied to a company's performance? Do we see that happening where as the company goes, so goes the CEO salary? And how often does that happen?
Well, it certainly is tied. But the question is, what's the measure of performance you're going to use? Is it overall stock market performance of the company? Is it performance of the company relative to equivalent companies? Is it performance relative to our own internal benchmarks? Is it performance relative to some other measure? And if you can keep changing the measures, and if you'll let me control my own measures, you know, I'm going to do particularly well. Now, one thing listeners probably don't know is that the companies engage their own consultants. It's an entire industry of compensation consultants to help them figure out how to pay the CEO, and the CEO runs a company, so I'm hiring people to help me figure out how to make my pay. Then the board hires its own compensation consultants as well. So you can see this is a full employment plan for compensation consultants. And they're basically spending all this time looking at each other and trying to figure out how much is everybody else being paid, right?
Yeah.
So it's kind of a really strange world right now.
Yeah. I want to invite our listeners to add their voices to our conversation. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, email us radiotimes@whyy.org, and of course, you can always call us 888-477-9499. We do have a number of comments and emails that have come in. I want to read, in the interests of fairness, a comment that came in via email from David related to CEO compensation. And he says, I had particular difficulty donating to WHYY when I found that the 2 weeks of fundraising interruption basically pay WHYY CEO's salary. David, the only thing that we can say to that is that that is, as we've been discussing, a decision that is made by our board of directors here at WHYY. So we have to leave it at that. But we appreciate that that you made that comment. And we think that in the interests of fairness, we will mention that. We've got a couple of other comments here. But before I get to that, I want to talk about some legislation that Elizabeth Warren has been promoting that has to do with the idea of worker representation on corporate boards. And there is some precedent for that, I understand. I'd love to hear your thoughts about inviting workers to be part of that process of deciding what CEOs make and being involved in that decision-making, at least to some degree.
Why don't I jump in on that one? You know, if you look at other parts of the world, it's a pretty common thing. In Germany, it's kind of legislated in by the way the governance of corporations is set up. We tried it in the U.S., actually. We tried it during a period of union concessions in the 1980s. A lot of unions, in order to persuade them to give up salary increases, put people on the board, their own members on the board. And what we discovered is it actually didn't change much. And the reason is once you're a board member, you have fiduciary legal obligations, which are the same as all the other board members. And you're kind of one voice, too, with respect to issues in a board of, you know, seven or eight more people. So you're vastly outnumbered. And so it really didn't change all that much in terms of the compensation in particular. And, you know, part of the problem is unless you're willing to change the way you think about the whole framework for setting compensation for CEOs, you know, what you're not going to pay your CEO compared to how everybody else is paid, you know, it's not going to make much difference. So it turns out I don't think it's going to change very much. You know, we've kind of tried that experiment and didn't alter very much, at least in the U.S.
Yeah. So even if, and I think her proposal was calling for something like, you know, two-fifths, you know, that 40% representation, or you put a number like that on it, does that then maybe move the needle some?
Well, you know, it's another thing to note that it used to be quite common in the U.S. that most of the board members were employees. They were executives, but they were all employees, right? And, of course, that didn't change anything. So I'm not so sure that if you got a big number on, yeah, probably would have some effect. But, again, it's the whole system, right? It's not individual companies just by themselves making crazy decisions. It's a whole practice across the industry, which is raised pay for everybody.
Yeah. Got a couple of comments here regarding the transparency issue and a couple of other things, but let me just read this one from Richard, who is talking to us via Facebook, who said, "When I worked for General Electric in the late 60s, we were represented by a union and everyone knew how much everyone else made. When I started with a new non-union company, I was warned that disclosing my salary was a fireable offense."
Right. So here's what's interesting about that. It's illegal. You can't do that. And it's protected by the National Labor Relations Act that employees are allowed to discuss, whether you have a union or not, your compensation with each other. You mentioned earlier this move toward greater transparency in the U.S. I'm not sure how much that's really true, but one thing which did change is that in 2009, President Obama issued an executive order that increased the punishments if you tried to discipline employees for talking about pay. Right. So that changed a bit.
Well, we've got much more to discuss on this topic when Radio Times comes right back, including the gender gap and what to do if you need to negotiate a raise for yourself. Radio Times will be back right after this. Welcome back to Radio Times. We're talking about paychecks, who makes what and why, and how the conversation around salaries is changing in the United States. Our guests are Nancy Rothbard, professor of management and chair, management department at Penn's Wharton School. Also with us is Peter Capelli, professor of management at Wharton and director of Wharton's Center for Human Resources. So we have been talking quite a bit about salary transparency, and we do have a couple of more listener questions about that we'll get to in a moment. We've been talking about CEO compensation packages. One of the things that we have not talked about thus far is the wage gap or the gender gap, and certainly any discussion of salaries, I think, has to include that. Nancy, what exactly do we mean when we use the term gender gap?
Well, I think we mean a lot of things, but there's a lot of causes of the gender gap, from segregation of women and men into certain occupations, which pay different levels, as well as inequity within the same job in terms of how people's performance is viewed, et cetera. And so, you know, when we think about the pay gap, it's basically that women are often paid less than men for doing a similar job. That's the most, you know, clean way of thinking about it. But what happens with transparency is really interesting, right? So there have been some studies that have shown that accountability is really important. So when employers are more accountable for reporting on, you know, the salaries of men and women, that gap starts to close. So, you know, if they have to publish that, you know, if they have to tell people, you know, what are the men and women making within a certain category of job, that gap starts to close. And so I think that this actually links back nicely to some of the things that Zoe was talking about earlier, which is around the sort of collective transparency. So knowing on average what the women in a certain job class make versus what the men in that same job class make, that can be really useful in terms of keeping people accountable and closing that gap. The challenge is, you know, going back to this pure transparency, is when you start to put names to that, people start to make all sorts of social comparisons, and you get some of the challenges that we were talking about earlier. So I think that this practice of this collective transparency and accountability is one that has proven to be quite effective in starting to close that gap.
Yeah. So in practice then, what does the gender gap look like? What does, on average, a woman get paid relative to her male counterparts at this point?
So, I mean, traditionally it was sort of, well, it's actually been moving. That number has been moving. And as of a couple of years ago, it was 78 cents on the dollar. And I don't know, Peter, are there any more updated numbers that you're aware of?
I think the number you hear now is 80%.
So it's 80 cents on the dollar.
Yeah. If you look at similar jobs, it's about 92%. Similar jobs, similar experience. There's this company called PayScale. And actually, if you want to know how much people in your company are paid, you can go on PayScale and they'll tell you, because they have 18 million people whose pay is on there. And they claim that in the same company for equivalent jobs, the gap is almost zero now. Right?
Really?
So the big gaps, as Nancy was saying, are because men and women are in different jobs and not always by choice. That's the big issue, I think.
Does the gender gap widen for women of color?
Oh, yes. There's a larger gap, definitely.
Yeah. And do we have an idea what the disparity is there? Or
I don't know what the specific numbers are, but there is research showing that there is a statistically significant difference for women of color as well.
And we noted just a moment ago that there is a degree of closure to that gap, but the fact is that women have been in the workforce now for decades. And so it raises the question, why does this disparity persist after all of these years? Especially as there are more women in the workplace, more women gaining higher levels of education, greater levels of skill. Why are we still talking about this?
So I think that it's related to the glass ceiling in part, you know, in that there are barriers at various levels for women to get into certain jobs. And that has, you know, for a long time, the answer to that was the pipeline. The pipeline's not there. Once the pipeline is there, that will be fixed. And we've seen over the last few years that glass ceiling is still quite firmly in place. And there are two sets of explanations for that. And that's related to the pay, obviously, because as Peter said, that's one of the major issues. One of the challenges is that women often are not seen as, you know, CEO material or, you know, higher level job material by others. And so that's, you know, that's a discrimination issue in terms of people's, you know, view of their talent and ability to fill those jobs. But the second issue is women's desire to fill those jobs. And, you know, there's some research that shows that women are often unwilling to, you know, to give up some of the flexibility that these other types of jobs offer in order to have a more all-consuming type of a role. And so, you know, there are two, you know, one of our colleagues, Matthew Bidwell, has a paper, you know, why aren't women in finance? You know, like what's happening there? And it's often because of choice that they don't want to go into these roles that are seen as toxic or these, you know, types of environments that are seen as toxic. Yeah. And so, you know, there's many explanations for this. It's not just one lens that we can put on it. It's a multifaceted problem.
But on the flip side of that, Nancy, you have those who will say this gender equality thing is a myth. You know, women, you know, either don't pursue those kinds of jobs. They take off time to have children. There are lots of reasons, and some of them true to your point, why women may make less than their male counterparts. But there are those who will say that's why gender equality as it relates to pay is a myth.
I mean, I think that that's if you think that that's all that's going on, then it's a myth. But I think that the issue is that's one set of explanations, and then there is another set, right, which have to do with perceptions of women's abilities, perceptions of women's willingness and desire to do these jobs. So sometimes women are interested in these jobs, and people don't see them as willing to do it. Or, you know, would you be willing to move to Europe for this promotion? And they assume that women wouldn't be likely to do that. And so there's both of those things going on. And because of that, that makes it really complicated to untangle. And also it makes it complicated for people to really feel like in any individual case, they know the right answer of, you know, what's happening for that individual. But when we look on average, we really can see the patterns.
Yeah. I was going to say that I'm not a psychologist, but I've certainly been impressed by the research in psychology showing all the different ways in which judgments take place. And even if you're not extremely biased, if you have hundreds of little judgments on somebody and there's a little bias in each one of them, at the end of 100, you get big effects.
Right? Yeah. People call it death by a thousand cuts, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, and that's a big issue with promotion of women into these roles. And them being seen as, you know, the kind of person to take that next job.
Yeah. I want to talk about negotiation, because one of the arguments is that women don't negotiate as well for themselves. And that can be an issue, male or female, when it comes to salary negotiation. But is there truth to that? Do women generally not negotiate as well for themselves? And what do you know about that?
So what the research on gender negotiation suggests is that women often don't ask, right? So they don't seize that opportunity to negotiate, number one. When they do ask, they're actually not worse at it than men. When they ask and negotiate on behalf of others, they're actually better than men. That's what the research shows. The last piece of the research on gender and negotiations, though, shows a really interesting finding that one of the reasons women don't ask, it's not that they're crazy not to ask. It's that sometimes when they ask, there is backlash. And so it does depend on how you ask. And asking is really important rather than demanding. If you're being seen as walking in there, you know, and demanding something, that is actually perceived fairly negatively, both for men and women. But women are often perceived as demanding if they're not couching their request in more relational language, using, you know, us and we versus I and me, for example, using, you know, the types of language which suggests that their ask is not just on behalf of them, but is to the betterment of the organization.
But is there not potentially a gender bias even there, Nancy?
Oh, yes.
Right? That,
definitely.
That while maybe it's true for men and women, is there more of an onus on women to soften their approach because they'll be seen in a more negative light if they go in being, if their assertiveness is perceived as aggressiveness, or if they are just flat out aggressive?
Absolutely. And that there is there, that's where the bias is, right? And that there is a bias about how women are perceived. And so we have to change our tactics to be equally effective.
So can I maybe jump in with one additional study here? This is one done by our colleague Corrine Lowe. And what she did is she, a lot of these studies are laboratory based, she added an additional layer of reality to this. And that is, it's possible in these negotiations, as Nancy is suggesting there, to blow them up, right? To ask for things and so irritate your party on the other side that say they don't give you the job or whatever. And she found that men were much more likely to blow these things up than women were. Right. And so in that context, you can see how we might want to soften some of these conclusions, because the studies were mainly based on how well did you do in a negotiation and didn't allow for the possibility that you could really damage the relationship by pushing too hard. And men were much more inclined to do that. Now, depending how you weight that possibility, it's not so clear that the overall results that women do worse are quite as powerful as they would have been otherwise.
Yeah. I want to read a comment from Michael on Facebook. He says, let's stop making salaries dependent on one's, quote, negotiation skills. This is nothing more than people with money deciding who gets paid what with no accountability as to why. Interesting point. which leads me to the question, for those who are listening who feel that they do deserve a raise, or they have found out that a coworker is being paid more for comparable work, and I'm talking male or female here, what advice do you have to that person who wants to initiate that conversation but has no idea how to go about doing it?
So what I would say is do your homework. And when I say do your homework, I mean do your homework very thoroughly, because when you just find out a number, that's one piece of the puzzle. You need to find out not just that one number, but you need to figure out what other, you know, a whole range of things, you know, how atypical is this? What are possible reasons for it? And understand that if you walk in there blind and haven't researched that and haven't understood what the potential reasons somebody's going to give you are for why that number is different, you're not going to get anywhere, right? And so you have to really do your homework thoroughly in order to figure out, A, is there really a gap? And B, if there is, what are the dimensions that people are going to say that the gap is based on, and are those valid?
Mm-hmm.
And
so you
can
have
you
to come
counter
in,
them?
Yeah, anticipating all of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. How do you go about doing that research? Because as I listen to that, I think about in a company where the information is not transparent, or you don't even have ballpark numbers, how do you go about getting a sense of what you're worth, what your coworkers are getting, what you might be worth in the midst of that, and how these salaries are set? So how do you go about trying to unearth that information?
So, Peter,
well, there are companies that'll do this for you. So I have no tie whatsoever to this company, PayScale. But what they do, if you go to their website, is that they'll ask you to put in your information about your job, where you are, that company name, and how much you're paid. And then they will give you back, here's how much people like you in your community, in this industry, in companies like yours are paid, right? So you can get it there. You know, I think that there is a difference that's a big one between going to your boss and saying, I deserve more money, and saying, I deserve more money than she does, right? Mm-hmm. That comes across as much more petty. And as Nancy's saying, you might find out answers to the question which are going to completely undermine whatever case that you would have made before about why you deserve more money, right? So I think, you know, you can go down a real rabbit hole with these concerns about, am I paid less than everybody else, and you can drive yourself nuts with it. And, you know, some perspective taking is probably useful on this. Yeah. You know, is it how big a deal really is it? How worked up should you be about an inequity that you might not completely understand how different it really is, or even if it's unjustified?
And, you know, just to add to that, you know, I think that Peter's suggestion is a great one. You know, going to, you know, a site that allows you to get these on average kinds of numbers helps you to get a range and a ballpark. You also can talk to people. As Peter said, it's not a problem to talk to people in your organization about what, you know, what you make and what they make, et cetera. It's you have to find, though, the right person. You know, in my experience, you have to find a person who is comfortable with that, who, you know, is equivalent to you, who, you know, has a lot of the features that it's going to be hard for people to say, no, that's not, you know, you're not equivalent to that person. And so, and you need to find more than one so that it's not, as Peter said, a tit for tat.
Yeah. Great advice. I'm sure there are a lot of people listening who will want to take that to heart as they begin to think through that process. We have been talking about salaries, about who makes what, about salary transparency, about CEO compensation, about the gender gap and how to help narrow that gap. All things paychecks today on Radio Times. And I want to thank our guests. I want to thank Nancy Rothbard and Peter Capelli, both from the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. Also thanks to Zoe Cullen, who joined us by phone from the Harvard Business School to share her insights. Our producers have been Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, Kelsey Hansen, and our engineer is Diane Martinez. And I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Muscoane. You have been listening to Radio Times on WHYY.